Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
If this program was about anthropology, we'd be calling the news of the day the missing link. As it is, we'll just say this. You want to know why Europe matters here? Allow us to introduce you to Dexia, the Belgian bank that couldn't. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Vast Conference. Conference calls that give you clarity, professionalism, and flexibility all at a low price. For two Vast Conference calls free with no commitment, go to vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday today, the 4th of October. Good to have you with us. And I'm going to level with you right here. We spend an inordinate amount of time around here trying to figure out how best to explain what's happening in Europe, both the nuts and the bolts, too much debt, not enough capital, and why it matters. What happens here if it all goes bad over there? Today, we had a really good, as in really bad, example fall right into our laps. The French and Belgian governments are promising they'll bail out a bank called Dexia. It's got a lot of Greek debt on its books, and you've probably never heard of it, but a ton of local governments here in the U.S. have. Marketplace's Amy Scott gets us going.
What does the Greek debt crisis have to do with an ice skating rink in a Seattle suburb? To help pay for the rink, the city of Everett, Washington, issued bonds. The bonds have an interest rate that can change every week, and investors can sell them back on short notice. Jeff White advises municipal bond issuers with Columbia Capital Management. He says that's where the French-Belgian bank Dexia stepped in.
Because most entities that issue these bonds don't just have a bunch of cash laying around to make good on the promise to buy those bonds back from the investors every week, they actually engage a bank to do that for them.
Dexia is now on thin ice because of all the Greek debt it owns, and muni investors are demanding higher interest rates on bonds backed by the bank. Peter Shapiro is with Swap Financial Group. He says that's raising borrowing costs.
The consequence for American cities and airports and highway systems and school systems is that if they have Dexia on their bonds, then the rate will tend to float much higher than it otherwise would.
Dexia backs at least $10 billion in variable-rate municipal bonds in the U.S., according to municipal market advisors. Until recently, these included bonds issued by the Texas Veterans Land Board, which provides home loans to veterans in the state. The board's Rusty Martin says its deal with Dexia was set to expire in November. He didn't wait.
Interest rates on bonds backed by Dexia started getting higher than other providers, so we went ahead and started pulling the trigger on replacing them.
Today, the French and Belgian governments tried to reassure markets, but advisor Jeff White says if governments have to do that, more bond investors might think it's time to head for the exits. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Wall Street managed to salvage an update today, as we'll tell you at the appropriate moment, but European markets had no such luck. Traders overseas were smacked with news that finance ministers are going to hold off giving Greece its next installment of bailout money, and they did it without a whole lot of notice either. They'd been expected to sign off on a new $11 billion loan for Athens next Thursday, until Greece said it's not going to be able to meet deficit reduction targets for the year after all. From Paris, John Lawrenson reports.
Whatever came out of that meeting in Luxembourg, it was not the firm, unanimous show of support for Europe's sickest economy that markets around the world hoped for. Milken Institute economist Jim Bart says European scepticism about the wisdom of another bailout is on the rise, whether or not Europe's leaders admit it publicly.
I think that's indeed a question that comes up in any behind-the-door discussions. One doesn't want to throw good money after bad.
When the Eurogroup first agreed this bailout back in July, Germany in particular made it plain that Greece would have to play ball if it was going to get its money. This week's Greek admission that they can't implement the deficit-cutting measures the Eurogroup and the IMF are demanding is not what Germany wants to hear. But, says Athens University economics professor Yanis Yarafakis, the Greek government does not have the authority to push these measures through.
So we have a political system which has lost its capacity to persuade the electorate regarding its intentions or its skills.
So now a stymied Greek political system has been met with a stymied European bailout. Jim Bart says the consequences for the US can only be bad.
if there's some restructuring or write-down of the debt of Italy or Spain, that could lead to a recession in Europe. That, in turn, could spill over adversely to the United States and even a country like China.
Now investors will have to wait and see whether the Eurozone economies will hand out the money Greece so desperately needs in November. In Paris, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders took the major indices for a bit of a ride, down on the Greek news, up on European bank news. A rally at the end keeps us out of an official bear market, for all the good that that does. The stock of the day this Tuesday is ticker symbol AAPL. The iPhone 5-less Apple ended just about where it started. More on that from our man in Silicon Valley coming up, and the stock market details, as always, when we do the numbers. We've seen the Greek riots on TV. We've read about austerity budgets and economic malaise. But Paul Mason sees it a little bit differently. He's been in and out of Athens for most of the past year in his job as an economics editor at the BBC. We reached him in London, where he's just back from Athens. Paul, good to have you with us.
Hi, Kai.
We wanted to get some sense from you of the difference between dissatisfaction and anger in Athens and what's happening in the streets.
I think there is certainly a lot of anger. But you're starting to see a different thing, though. It's been called anomy, after a famous term used by the sociologist Durkheim. The sort of low-level listlessness of people in the street, you know, people getting out of their cars and lifting up the toll booth barrier and saying, I'm not paying. Stuff like that.
What happens when that happens? You know, when there is this anomy, as you say?
Well, suicides have gone up. Suicides are up 40% in a year. You have a big rise in violent crime. And I mean, the other thing that people tell me is they're switching off the TV. They can't stand anymore. I mean, I've talked to a number of social theorists who think that, you know, there might come a moment where people just snap. And who knows what they do.
Have you been following the Occupy Wall Street protests happening over here?
I certainly have, yes.
What do you think?
The interesting thing is that what you've now got in your country are, you know, we've had the Tea Party, who were very exercised by the bailout of Wall Street, and quite similar to some of the people I've met in Athens. Because remember, in Athens, it's not just left-wing protesters. There are right-wing, religious and nationalist protesters as well. And in Athens, they came together. This hasn't happened in America yet. Mm. But I would imagine one wants to keep an eye on Occupy Wall Street in case that dynamic does begin to, as it were, resonate with some of the people who originally were out there for Tea Party events.
When the government comes out in Athens and says, listen, we don't have the money. We've been not collecting taxes for too long, and there's waste and corruption, and we have to fix it, and it's going to be bad. Does that carry any weight?
Well, it certainly does carry weight. But remember that everybody's always got their own excuse for this. Yeah. The small business people are saying, look, the problem we've got is the tax environment is not predictable. Every few weeks brings a new tax. I mean, and the 2 billion euro tax they slapped on only last week will be collected through electricity bills. So there's no way of avoiding it. There is anecdotal evidence that the super rich of Greece have left the country. And I think a lot of Greek people think, well, hold on a minute. You know, we're not all in this together. There is the super rich seem to have an outlet.
The ones who are tuning out, who can't bear it anymore and who are lifting up those toll gates to bypass the toll booths, are they what used to be the middle class, I guess?
I think they are the middle class. I mean, when I was there, I saw the protesters who went to sabotage the sale of repossessed homes. And when I started asking, well, what do you do? It's, I'm an IT professional. I'm an advertising executive. And these are not the kind of people I would normally associate with direct action protest.
Where does this go if, as you have said in some of your pieces, there's only more pain ahead?
A lot of people secretly believe Greece will default on its debts. Then it will go on life support from the European Union, and it will have to do austerity. But what it might get then is a little bit of breathing space to do the structural reforms it needs to do. So what some of the Greek politicians say in background is, look, Europe needs to give us time to do this, because really we're going through a sort of post-1989, you know, Soviet Union-style change in our economy, but we can't do it in an atmosphere of constant crisis.
Paul Mason, covering Athens for the BBC and their program Newsnight. Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, my colleague Jeremy Hobson's live from London with Stephen Beard and the latest on the European debt crisis. Ben Bernanke schlepped up Capitol Hill again today for an appearance before Congress, spent a lot of time explaining why the recovery doesn't feel like one, said it's faltering, in fact. The debt crisis in Europe, weak consumer confidence, poor job growth, all of them, he said, weighing down U.S. growth. Mr. Bernanke said the Fed is ready to help where it can, which is a position not without its critics. Commentator Amity Schles, however, isn't one of them.
The nastier people are when they make an argument, the less evidence they have for it. That's one of the iron rules of life, and it also holds for the attacks on Ben Bernanke. Politicians might say the Fed chairman is overreaching or imperial, but they're skipping the substance. The substance is that Bernanke did not make the Fed arrogant. The Fed's arrogance is institutional, based on laws passed long before Bernanke was born. After the unemployment of the Great Depression, presidents and Congress wanted to assure people that Washington would never let such unemployment occur again. Jobs, jobs, jobs were it. So Congress passed, and President Truman signed, a law called the Employment Act of 1946. Nothing subtle about that name. Even if jobs weren't the Fed's traditional mandate, the Fed knew it had to help. Presidents helped, too. Presidents Eisenhower and Truman picked officials for the Fed who believed the Fed should manage both employment and growth. That extra Fed job of managing employment was formalized in a later law. It was passed while Ben Bernanke was a mere grad student at MIT. This next Fed law, known as Humphrey-Hawkins, mandated that the Fed watch long-term growth. That's now code for unemployment. So twice a year, the Fed chairman has to testify in front of Congress, and that means a grilling about jobs. But the thing is, government, whether the Fed, Treasury, or Congress, hasn't proven very good at creating jobs in these last crisis years. Turns out a jobs obsession doesn't always lead to jobs. It is the private sector's turn to try to make jobs. But that private sector can only do so if the Fed moves out of the private sector's way. And that won't happen no matter how hyperbolic the critics get. The solution is a new Fed law that narrows the Fed's mandate to keeping money stable. Then the critics won't need to vilify the Fed head, whether it's Ben Bernanke or someone else.
Amity Schles is a senior fellow in economic history at the Council on Foreign Relations. Send us your comments. Online works best. Marketplace.org is our website. Click on the link that says contact. Coming up, crime rate? What crime rate?
In tribal societies, an average of about 15% of people met their ends through violence. In the 20th century, you get to about 3%.
The latest installment of Freakonomics Radio. But first, let's do the numbers. A plan to shore up European banks helped pull markets out of another downward spiral today. The Dow Industrials added 153 points, 1.4%. Finished at 10,808. The Nasdaq rose 68 points, almost 3%, ended at 2,404. The S&P 500 lifted 24 points, 2.25%, finished at 1,123. Financials helped lead the comeback. Morgan Stanley deposited 12%. J.P. Morgan Chase banked 6.5% today. Energy stocks also bounced back from early losses. Shares of ConocoPhillips and ExxonMobil picked up more than 2%. Chevron fueled up 1.75% today. Over in Motown, GM revived 8.5% higher, while Ford sped 7.5% ahead. The rally didn't help Apple, though investors were less than impressed with the company's new iPhone 4S. More on that in a minute. Shares dropped about 0.5%. Google added more than 1.25%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.82%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Vast Conference, the service that gives clarity, professionalism, and flexibility for conference calls at a low price. Vast provides both regular and toll-free numbers so you can set up calls anytime and provides web tools to manage or record calls instantly. Priced at 2.5 cents per minute with no commitments or contracts, try Vast Conference with two free calls at vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace. That's vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace. From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, a House subcommittee on commerce, manufacturing, and trade discusses protecting children's privacy in an electronic world. The Nobel Prize in Chemistry is announced in Stockholm. And shine that apple. The United Nations marks World Teachers Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The cynical among us would call it a bait and switch. Others would just say, hey, it's still pretty good, even if it's not an iPhone 5. We are, of course, talking about Apple and its latest consumer product extravaganza. Actually, that's not fair, because today's release of what turned out to be an iPhone 4S was actually far smaller than similar events in the not-so-distant past. Marketplace's Steve Henn is on the line to talk about it all. Hey, Steve.
Hey.
So, no iPhone 5, man. You disappointed?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people are. The headline about today's release are likely to be all about what Apple didn't do. You know, there's no iPhone 5, and that disappointed Apple customers and Apple investors. The stock was down 5% after the announcements wrapped up. And also, Apple didn't stage a really big event like they have in the past. This was Tim Cook's first time introducing a product as the permanent CEO of Apple. And the company held the announcement in Apple's Cupertino headquarters. It's a much smaller venue than the places they've used in the past, and they let far fewer reporters into the building. So you kind of have to wonder if Apple's PR team was trying to protect Cook from facing a lot of direct comparisons with Jobs.
Yeah, did you try to get in?
I did, I didn't get in.
Wow. All right, so help me out here in understanding what exactly they did say. There's no iPhone 5, but there is this iPhone 4S and a new pricing structure as well, right?
Yeah, that's right. So the iPhone 4S is basically identical to the iPhone 4 on the outside. On the inside, it's different. You know, it has faster chips and a better camera. But probably the biggest difference is a new feature they're adding called Siri. This basically lets you talk to your phone. It's a voice-activated...
don't you always talk to your phone? But anyway, go ahead.
I swear at my phone occasionally, but it's a voice-activated personal assistant. So what Siri does is try to actually understand what you mean and what you want using the context of your questions. So I spoke with a guy named Norman Winarski. He works at SRI, a nonprofit research group that developed the technology and sold it to Apple.
This is more of a do engine than a search engine. This is more of not getting links, but getting answers. This is more responding with actions. This is, you know, get me a hotel reservation, buy me a ticket, make this calendar adjustment.
All right, that sounds nifty and all, but is it enough of a big deal to get past the fact that there's no iPhone 5?
Well, we'll have to see. But, you know, if you remember back to when Google's Eric Schmidt was testifying on the Hill a couple weeks ago, he kept telling members of Congress that when folks search on a mobile phone, they don't want what Google used to deliver, which is a page full of links. Mm-hmm. What they want are answers, right? And this delivers answers. So if this changes the way people use their mobile phone to search and discover things online, it could be a big deal. You know, right now, Google owns something like 90% of the mobile search market. If Siri takes off, you know, Google could stand to lose a big chunk of that business, at least on the iPhone.
Before I let you go, Steve, a question about the wireless companies, AT&T, of course, and Sprint and Verizon. Does this no iPhone 5 thing mean anything for them?
Well, you know, Sprint got the iPhone, so that's good news for it. The question is, you know, how much did it have to give up to Apple to get it? There were stories that it promised to purchase something like 30 million phones. And if that's the case, that's a huge risk for Sprint, especially without a sleek, fancy new iPhone 5.
Marketplace's Steve Henn on a day when there was, you know, moderate Apple news. Steve, thanks a lot.
Sure thing. Take care.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. This time, though, a special treat, the other co-author, Stephen Levitt. Gentlemen, welcome to the broadcast.
Hey, Kai.
Great to be here.
So, Dubner, you are not in New York. You have gone to the city of Big Shoulders, Chicago, with your comrade there, Mr.
Levitt. I've come out to Chicago to try to persuade Levitt to run for president, because I thought it'd be fun.
We have a guy from Chicago already,
Well, I know, but, we've talked before on this show about how the president of the United States doesn't really matter that much, so I figure even if Levitt stinks, it wouldn't be any great loss. And unlike most economists, he'll admit that the president can't control or even predict the economy very well, but there are some useful things he actually does know about. For instance, what causes crime to rise and fall?
All right, Levitt, do tell. What do you know? What do you know about crime?
Well, let me start by saying I absolutely, categorically, am not running for president.
I don't think you have to worry about that.
If nominated, I will not run. If elected,
right.
I will not serve.
That's right.
When it comes to crime, one thing that I think I know that many people seem not to know is that crime has gone down, way down. And while many people are haunted by the thought that crime is high and rising, it categorically is not doing that.
Yeah, I mean, contrary to popular belief, the world is a more peaceful place today than literally at any time in history by a long, long shot.
I'm going to need something better than long, long shot. Quantify for me, Dubner.
All right. So the Harvard psychology professor Steven Pinker has just published a new book called The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. Huh. And he argues that our rosy view of history is pretty much entirely wrong.
In tribal societies, hunter-gatherers and hunter-horticulturalists, an average of about 15% of people met their ends through violence. Huh. In the 20th century, if you try to come up with the highest estimate you can, combining all the wars, all the genocides, all the man-made famines, you get to about 3%.
So that's 3% of non-natural, right? I mean, people who met their deaths by other means, right?
Yeah, violent, and he's including there, man-made famines, famines caused by civil war, whatnot. Yeah. And keep in mind also, in the 20th century, we had mechanized weapons, so killing becomes easier. That early violence was carried out in much more rudimentary ways. Here's Pinker again talking about 16th and 17th century England.
Samuel Pepys in his diary talks about going to the town square and watching a general being drawn and quartered. And in the next sentence, he talks about going to a pub and having some oysters. It was such a routine part of his day. In the era of Henry VIII, I think 10 people were executed a week.
Ouch. So, Levitt, what's the trend, though? I mean, America in 20th, 21st century, how are we doing?
Well, we've been doing pretty well lately. There was a very auspicious trend from the 60s to roughly 1990 with crime going up and up and up. But over the last two decades, crime in the U.S. has fallen in half.
How come?
Well, I think there are really three factors that explain most of it. And the first is just we've dramatically increased the prison population. There are now 3 million people behind bars in the United States, up from maybe 500,000. We've hired a lot of police as well. That's another factor that matters. And a third factor people think a lot about and that seems to be important is the rise and fall of the crack cocaine markets and the violence associated with that. The rise in the late 80s led to a lot of increase in crime and then the decline with the falling apart of those markets. And I have my own pet theory, and not that many people agree with me, but I do think the data support it, which is that the legalization of abortion in the 1970s led many of the people most at risk for crime never to have been born. Mm. And so when they would have grown up 20 years later, they just weren't here to do the crimes.
All right. But Dubner, make the connection for me between a lousy economy and crime, because you'd think it would go up.
You would think. And even though the evidence argues against it over and over again, smart people still think that it will. So crime actually fell during the Great Depression when the economy was in the toilet. Now, that was in part because Prohibition had ended. Crime spiked during the 1960s when the economy was booming. And in this most recent recession, despite a lot of predictions to the contrary, violent crime has continued to fall against really, all the smart money bet against it.
If there's one bet you will win. Yeah. It is a bet that the next time that crime falls when the economy is bad, the headline of the New York Times article that talks about crime falling will say, in spite of everyone's prediction, because of the poor economy, that crime would rise, crime has fallen. You can see the same sentence written 14 times by the New York Times.
Levitt, let me ask you this question, though, because if you go out there and ask people today, ask 10 people on the corner of the street outside my studio here in Los Angeles today, they will probably say that year over year, crime is getting worse. And yet your data shows it's not. What's that about?
I think people in general are terrible at assessing risks, that we very naturally overestimate dramatic things. So come to death, as an example. Things like airplane crashes or terrorist attacks are very vivid and attract a lot of attention, whereas we systematically understate the likelihood of dying from those kind of deaths, which are slow and silent and involve wasting away. Those don't make the headlines, and so we don't really think of the risk associated with, say, eating way too many cheeseburgers the same way we do as being shot out of the sky by missiles hitting airplanes.
Freakonomicsradio.com is the website. Stephen Dubner, Stephen Levitt, thanks, you guys.
Talk to you soon, guys.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
These final notes on the way out today. First of all, something's rotten in Charlotte, North Carolina, and Bank of America is not talking about it. It's 5 days in a row now that B of A's website has been sluggish at best. A spokeswoman said today little other than to deny that the country's biggest bank is being hacked and that they are continuing to assess the situation, she said. She also did not say when it would get better. And in other news that might excite a few of you or perhaps cause you to roll your eyes, coming off the whopping success of The Lion King 3D, the Walt Disney Company has announced it's going to roll out a few more of their modern classics in three dimensions, four films to be exact, starting with Beauty and the Beast, January of next year, followed by Finding Nemo, Monsters, Inc., and of course, The Little Mermaid. No, those kids can't grow up fast enough, I got to tell you. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow gained 153 points in a late, late day rally, 1.4%, finished at 10,808. The NASDAQ rose 68 points, almost 3%, 2404 the number. The S&P 500 added 24 points, 2.25%, finished at 1123. Thanks to Doug Krisner, Ethan Lindsay, and Jolie Podokas on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time back here, the key to making college more affordable.
If they work very hard and they can complete a course in 6 or 7 weeks instead of 15, we can accelerate time to degree.
Less time, less money. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, that's American Public Media.